What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning into this episode of Eyewitness History. I'm, of course, your host, Josh Cohen. This episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Mark Boletta. Mark is an attorney who served as general counsel to the Office of Management and Budget from January 8th, 2018 to January 20th, 2021. Prior to that post, Boletta served as chief counsel and assistant to Vice President Mike Pence from early 2017 to early 2018. He's also a close friend of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas and was instrumental in getting Clarence Thomas confirmed as a Supreme Court justice. He's written a new book, which has just been released this past week, called Created Equal, Clarence Thomas in His Own Words, along with Michael Pack. We discuss the book. We certainly discuss his experience being involved in the Supreme Court nomination hearings, what his thoughts were at the time as they were happening, and we do discuss the recent Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. So perhaps I'll lead with just a slight health warning that this episode does blur the lines a little bit between history and politics, as so many historical events do. And so with that warning out of the way, I will now give you Mark Boletta. Okay, I'm here with Mark Boletta. Mark, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Josh, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. I'm very excited to have you on. There's lots I want to discuss with you, Mark. I want to discuss your brush with history. I also want to touch on some very recent history, which I suspect you can guess at, but we'll get there. And lastly, most importantly, I want to discuss your book, co-authored with Michael Pack, Created Equal, Clarence Thomas in His Own Words. But before we get into all that, Mark, please tell listeners that might not be familiar with you who you are and what you do.
I'm an attorney here in Washington, D.C. I've been in and out of government. You know, I went into the Bush 41 White House when I was 26 years old in presidential personnel and helped on judicial selection, including Justice Thomas to the D.C. Circuit, was involved with his confirmation in 1991. Obviously, President Bush lost in 92. I've been went into private practice, was up on the Hill for 10 years doing congressional oversight as a chief counsel for a committee, and then left after 10 years. Was in private practice and went back into the government. I was in the Trump White House first as the counsel to Vice President Pence, and then as the general counsel to the Office of Management and Budget. But through all of that, the confirmation of Justice Thomas has stayed with me in that fight. And out of that fight was born a friendship. And we've been very close for these 30 years. And I've, you know, written a lot and set up websites to defend and what I'll say, promote the legacy and jurisprudence and life of Justice Thomas, who I consider to be our greatest justice and our greatest living American.
Excellent. Yeah, well, that if I can wind the clock back a little bit then, Mark, when was it that you first met Clarence Thomas? Can you recall that meeting?
Oh, absolutely. I was actually a college senior in 1983, and I was interning in Washington, D.C., and my mentor knew Vice President Bush, who was going to go up and campaign for my uncle, who was the Republican mayor of Bridgeport, Connecticut, of all things. And I'm from Connecticut. And I flew up on Air Force Two and came off the front of the plane with President Bush, which was just a great. My uncle standing there on the tarmac and figure out how I got in this plane. but after the event, it was like a 5:30 event. Vice President Bush went on to Staten Island to go to another fundraiser. And I was home and it was a Thursday. I remember I was going to stay overnight. And then EEOC Chairman Clarence Thomas was at another event at a university that my mentor was the president of, Tom Milady, and they came over to the hotel in the lobby, and we ended up sitting with him for about an hour or so and talking to him, and just was really struck by this man and his energy and his enthusiasm and the way he treated me, you know, who was just a college student. Loved talking to him then, and then went on with my life. I ended up in the White House in 1989. And one of the very first things, I was on the judicial selection President's Judicial Selection Committee with a number of people, and I was obviously the most junior person. And they were considering him to go on the D.C. circuit, and they wanted to kind of check him out, right, in terms of his what he's written, what he's done, all that kind of stuff. So I volunteered. I think I may have referenced, I met him before, to call him and get his material. So I called EEOC Chairman Clarence Thomas and said, we're looking at you for an appointment. I'd love to, you know, we'd love to get all your writings, you know, the speeches you've given, the articles you've done. You know, we're going to do our own kind of, this is before, right, the internet. So kind of gathering of information was a lot more difficult. And I ended up having an hour-long conversation with him then, you know, and he's just so dynamic and fun and engaging. And he sent everything to me. I still have that letter in March of 89 and read his material. And it was just, I would say it was electrifying, right? He was talking about his incredible American life. And so much of Justice Thomas, when he's talking about lessons, he's building it into his life story. So you're reading about this amazing life, which we can talk about, but then taking on Congress, taking on the civil rights leadership who were just bashing Clarence Thomas. And he was just calling him out and just, you know, throwing it down. And I thought, wow, this guy's the man. But could he get confirmed? And you know, when we were in the White House, I think there were 57 Democrats. And, you know, could he get confirmed the circuit? So in any event, recommended him into this group, you know, kind of gave the debrief and the like. They were already interested in, they needed to do that vet, you know, process. So that was me as the grunt kind of lawyer in the process. And the president selected him. I got to know Justice Thomas at that time and became, you know, sort of close with him. And then when he gets nominated for the Supreme Court, in fact, the day that Boyden Gray calls Clarence Thomas on the D.C. circuit, he says, and Thurgood Marshall has just announced his resignation. Mm-hmm. Clarence asks Boyden to have me sent over to get him because we're going to bring him to the Department of Justice. So right from the get-go, I was involved with kind of the confirmation process. And then I was basically his key aide during the confirmation fight, you know, for this is summer and fall of 1991.
Excellent. Excellent. So as a key aide during the course of the hearings, what would you say your day-to-day responsibilities were?
Well, literally from the day he was nominated, it was bashing, you know, batting down every rumor and falsehood that was out there, whether it was he had a Confederate flag on his desk, whether he had a tax lien on his house, his tax cheat, all this Louis Farrakhan stuff, domestic violence. So it was, to Justice Thomas's credit, he was nominated on a Monday and up in Kennebunkport, he came back, you know, and there's all these big teams put together, right? I remember coming into the chief of staff's office and there's a 30 people there. This is going to be the team. But Justice Thomas knows those are teams, right? And then you need your real team, right? And so on that Saturday morning, he brought me over. I went over to his chambers and we went through, and I knew him, but not like this, right? And he went through his Rolodex with me to tell me who's this person, so that when things would come up, right, I would have the names, I have a sense, right, and I could call him real quick. But I was able to then reach out to people through his life to, you know, get the right information to knock it down. And then it was kind of building support for Justice Thomas. You know, there was a team at the Department of Justice that was going through all the kind of the what I'll call the Supreme Court stuff of, you know, answering questions on all the different kind of constitutional issues that you're going to get asked about. And remember, Justice Thomas had been a judge for 18 months on the D.C. Circuit, written a number of opinions. But for any judge, even, you know, Justice Gorsuch, who I helped prepare, you know, you're going to go back over everything, right? So you have a Department of Justice team that's working with you. And you know, they'd give Justice Thomas these big binders to read and he'd read them and then they'd go over them, right? But my role was to help him on all the incoming and then actually build support on the outside with different groups and people and get together like packages of, you know, sort of his speeches, articles, that sort of stuff, background to go build support out in the community.
Excellent. Excellent. Thanks, Mark. You know, as you're talking, I'm thinking I want to give our listeners a sense of what it would actually be like to be there. And I think the way I want to ask is this, I believe this is covered in the book as well. Then Senator Joe Biden held the Senate confirmation hearings, and Thomas famously said that he had no idea what Biden was talking about when they get onto the bit about natural law and the rest of it. So my question, Mark, is going to be, how would you describe Biden's, let's call it, demeanor and behavior during the hearings?
Well, Joe Biden, you know, as Justice Thomas said, you know, broke his word to him in terms of running a fair hearing. You know, from the very get-go, right, it was the first question. Justice Thomas talks about how he, you know, Joe Biden brought Ginny, Clarence Thomas's wife, and him up to the hearing room a little bit before the first day of hearings and said, hey, here's the hearing room. You're going to be nervous. I'm going to throw you a softball, let you get your feet, you know, sort of wet and comfortable. And so the very first question Joe Biden asks him is this quote that Clarence Thomas had said about Stephen Macedo. And some of what Stephen Macedo, I think, was a Harvard professor on property rights or something like that. And he truncates the quote so that it looks like Clarence Thomas is saying something completely different than what he has said. And I think when Thomas heard those words, he's like, that doesn't sound like something I would say. And so, of course, it was, you know, he was like there kind of thrown. And of course, it, you know, a couple rounds later, Hatch comes along. Of course, this is one of those things you do. Everyone sort of, what, you find the quote, you find this article, and you realize, oh, this is what happened. You know, Biden is misrepresenting it completely. So we work with the senators to kind of get that stuff out there, right? So Hatch comes along and says, here's the entire quote. It's obviously clear what Justice Thomas, Clarence Thomas was saying. And so, you know, it was that kind of stuff that Biden was doing, I think, throughout. You talked about this. There's this great scene, and we'll talk about more, and Created Equal, Clarence Thomas, in his own words, is this new book, is based on this documentary that Michael Pack made of the same name that was aired on PBS and in theaters. I urge everyone to go rent it right now and watch it. You'll love it. 100% guarantee you will love it. But in there, there's this great exchange where Joe Biden is basically saying on natural law, nobody here who's watching will understand what we're saying, but you know it's important. I know it's important, but no one else is going to understand our exchange right now. And it's the most buffoonish thing. And you can tell, like, this is Biden's history, right? Of lying about, like, his grades and lying about his scholarships. It goes right back. He just is a fabulist, right? And so I'm sure he prepped, right, with Ron Klein and others to kind of get ready for this moment. But it came off as so fake, right?
Yeah.
So buffoonish, really. And Justice Thomas says in the movie, I had no idea what he was talking about. And you're trained to sit there and look like you're listening to them. One of the things Justice Thomas said, and I'll just a little digression here.
No.
One of the things that helped him was that he was at the EEOC for many, many years, for 8 years, I think. And he had 60 oversight hearings where these Democrats just bashed the heck out of him, right? And say all sorts of things and get into this gotcha game. That's what he calls these things. This is not an exchange of information. This is gotcha. So it was a silver lining of having been bashed for many, many years as an EEOC chairman. And that, so being ready for these hearings, he knew what this game was, right? This was not an honest assessment of what Justice Thomas thought or what his approach to judging would be. This was, how can we trip Clarence Thomas up and blow him up, right? That's what this is all about. And I think Biden showed that, and the rest of them did. When you think about, you know, like Ted Kennedy, of all people, sitting there, right? It's just astonishing to me. But that's what it was. But like I said, Thomas was ready. He understood what I'll call the game. Justice Thomas had the longest set of hearings in history to this day. And those hearings, I think, went to September 16th. I think it was 16th. And then obviously the second set of hearings with the Anita Hill allegations. But yeah, Biden was, you know, he's just, in my view, he's craven and he's weak, right? And it's all for politics. And, you know, he's the one who did the Bork hearings. He's the one who destroyed Robert Bork and did it intentionally. And if you remember, there was this great quote from his wife back then that attacking Bork was as a way for Joe Biden to get back in the game. And so he decided he was going to, I think he had said some complimentary things about Bork before those hearings, but then he changed and he utterly savages him because of his political calculation of what was going to help him.
So I suppose, Mark, it's the Anita Hill thing that would be one of the more salient things that people would remember from those hearings. Maybe we can talk a little bit more about that. I'd love to know, when did the Anita Hill allegations first present themselves, and what was your reaction?
So the Anita Hill allegations came out of the blue. Remember, Justice Thomas was nominated, announced on July 1st of 1991. And we had gone, you know, he had gone through those hearings, which were in September. September 10th was the first set of hearings. I think they ended like the 16th or 17th. They were the longest hearings, I think, in history. After those hearings, Anita Hill came forward. So she filed a statement with the Senate Judiciary Committee on September 23rd. So just think about in terms of the timing. Thomas has finished his hearings. He's been nominated back in July 1st. Remember, Justice Thomas has been through four FBI background checks for his previous jobs, and nothing of the sort had ever kind of come up in his background checks. And so the allegations get made on the 23rd. It's a statement. We could talk about a little bit for that, which we didn't know anything about. But on September 23rd, she files this statement, and the FBI goes and interviews her, Justice Thomas, another person, Susan Hirshner, who Anita Hill claimed she had spoken with at the time of the alleged conduct, and then two other people that Anita Hill had recommended that just FBI talk to support her claims. And I'll just fast forward for your listeners that after all those hearings were done, and they heard from Justice Thomas, they heard from Anita Hill, they heard from a number of people, the American people believed Clarence Thomas 58% to 24% that he was telling the truth, and only 26% of women believed Anita Hill. So there was no gender gap. And so to this day, and when it happened, I thought these allegations were a lie. They were not truthful, and they crumbled when you had it tested in terms of her story. And that's why I think, again, the American people didn't believe her. So Anita Hill claimed in her allegations that she went to work for Clarence Thomas at the Department of Education in 1981, right? In August of 1981, she goes to work for him as a special assistant. He's just arrived at the Department of Education in the Reagan administration. She claims that after a few months, 3 months, she says in her testimony, that he started to sort of talk about pornographic films and scenes with animals and other sorts of, you know, sort of pornographic discussions in the office, and then he pressed her for dates. Okay, so wasn't anything about sort of touching or making, you know, those sorts of advances. It was kind of this dirty talk, disgusting talk. And that, and the strange thing is that she then follows him to another job. So she's at the Department of Education. She claims this starts to happen after 3 months. Clarence Thomas gets appointed to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, EEOC, the following spring. And you'd think that a Yale educated, Anita Hill went to Yale Law School, graduate would be thrilled that her sexual harasser was leaving her place and she could continue to go on at the Department of Education while Clarence Thomas went on to a new job. No, she followed him to the EEOC. So when she was confronted in the hearings about why would you follow your alleged harasser, she lied. She said that she thought this is Senator Spector who asked her, she tried to imply that she was a political appointee, and, you know, political appointees can be removed. They don't have any career protections as an employee. It was determined that she was a career employee and that she could stay there. So he confronted with her that, and she said, I didn't know I was a career employee, or I didn't know that I could stay. She then said, I didn't know who Thomas's successor was. You know, I thought that person might get rid of me. Well, Thomas's successor, Harry Singleton, came forward and said, I was at the department for 4 weeks before Anita Hill left. I sat right down the hall from her. I asked her to stay with me at the department. And she said, no, I'm going with Clarence. Then she said something like the Department of Education was going to be abolished. Ronald Reagan had, you know, said he was going to abolish it during the campaign, which is just absurdity, right? Obviously, the Department of Education is bigger and worse than ever, but it's still it's still standing. But even more fundamentally, Josh, in terms of this whole story, there's so many holes in it and inconsistencies. One of them being when she came forward, she said that she had spoken to one person about this at the time. So remember, 1981. And she says it's Susan Hirshner. So that's the FBI interviews Susan Hirshner. Susan Hirshner talks to the Senate Judiciary Committee when Anita Hill is first coming forward. Okay. And she tells the committee that she spoke to Anita Hill once. She changed it to a couple times in her Senate interview. But the key point is that she spoke to her during the spring of 1981. And if you look on, so I have a website I set up called AnitaHillCase.com. And on there is a chronology. There's a lot of documents. It's a comprehensive review of those hearings, okay? Underlying documents and things like that, things that were sealed that I got a hold of and put up on the website. One of them is a chronology that the Biden staff put out during the hearings, you know, to go through their dealings with Anita Hill when she was thinking about coming forward. And one of them is that Susan Hirshner said she spoke to Anita Hill in the spring of 1981, okay? That was their first contact. When she has an interview with committee staff a little bit later, they go back over this thing, okay? The only problem with this story is that Anita Hill did not work for Clarence Thomas in the spring or summer of 1981. She goes to work for him at the end of August of 1981. By her own testimony, she says it starts about 3 months later, which puts you in November. Now, Susan Hirshner said, I spoke to Anita Hill. I used to be, I was in contact with her. I stopped actually talking to her as those things go because she moved away from Washington, D.C. Right? They were both in Washington, D.C. at the time. How does she date that in terms of when she was being interviewed? She said, I left in August of 1981 because my father was sick and I needed to leave to go back to San Francisco to take care of him. After I left Washington, I basically didn't talk to Anita Hill anymore and I ran into her at some conference. So that's a pretty good sort of time sequence in terms of like, kind of dating when you spoke to Anita Hill. When she's confronted by this in the Senate staff interview by a Republican counsel who says, okay, you know, it dawns on her that her story is wrong. It doesn't match up. And so she asks for a timeout. Her lawyer does. And her lawyer is actually Anita Hill's lawyer, Janet Napolitano, who becomes the, you know, DHS secretary, right?
Yeah.
But she was being a lawyer for both of them. They go outside the room and she comes back in and she says, you know, I can't remember the last time I spoke to Anita. I can't remember when I had these conversations, but there is contemporaneous evidence, including the Biden chronology, right, where she had already spoken to them, where she says it's the spring of 1981. So backing up, and I'm sort of jumping back and forward in this story. Clarence Thomas says that when, you know, the reason he hired Anita Hill was because his best friend in the world, Gil Hardy, who he went to Holy Cross with and Yale Law School with, and they were best men in each other's weddings, and it was a Black graduate of Yale Law School, had said to Clarence Thomas, hey, can you help out Anita Hill? She's having trouble at our law firm. Gil Hardy was a lawyer at World Harcourt and Ross, where Anita Hill was, and she was not doing well. And so Clarence, because he's such a great guy and is friends with is Gil Hardy, who's calling him to help a friend, agrees to hire her. It turns out, though, when he meets with Anita Hill, she says, I detest Ronald Reagan, right? Now, Clarence Thomas is a political appointee in the Reagan administration. As he says in the book, you know, look, when people are down, I couldn't get a job when I came out of Yale Law School, right? I struggled to kind of make my way. So when somebody's struggling, you're obligated to help them, right? And so his friend came to him. Here is this woman who was kind of failing out of her law firm, and she's a Democrat, but he's going to find a way to help her. So he gets her hired as this career attorney, right? If you remember from the hearings, the whole sort of the whole image of Anita Hill was that she was this Reaganite, who was conservative, who had no axe to grind. That is 1,000% false and was a lie and was perpetrated by the media to make it look like Anita Hill would not have an agenda. She had a guy testify. So we're kind of talking about her witnesses too. She had a person testify named Joel Paul, who was a professor who is at American University at the time. And I think Anita Hill was somehow, I can't remember, she was at American in the lunchroom talking to the professors, and he said when he spoke with her, it was during the work confirmation hearings. Mm-hmm. And during his testimony at the Hill-Thomas hearings, he says, she was this huge Reagan fan. She loved Robert Bork. She supported Robert Bork's confirmation. You know, she was a through and through kind of conservative. That's just an absolute lie. And in fact, Anita Hill's book, which she publishes many years after the confirmation hearing in 1997, goes through how she hated Reagan. She felt like she was being dipped in a vat of boiling oil when she had to talk about, you know, Reagan's policies, that she didn't support Robert Bork. He was somebody, I think, that may have been her professor and he should have been treated respectfully, but she did not support Robert Bork's confirmation, okay, or nomination.
Yeah.
So all of these sort of kind of lies, in my view, about Anita Hill. So you have this you know, and Joe Biden stumbles into this thing when he asks her, why did you leave your law firm? And she said, nobody talked to me about leaving. And again, people were watching these hearings, and she, and this gentleman named, by the name of John Burke, who's a Democrat living up in Boston, had been at Wald Hargrave, had actually supervised her on a number of cases or a number of matters, and had spoken with her about how her work was not up to par and maybe she should find another, you know, we will help you find another job. He swears out an affidavit to this effect, right? I think he first contacts the Kennedy office, Senator Kennedy office, because he's up in Boston, but he gets savaged for basically telling his recollection of dealing with Anita Hill. And in fact, she was failing out of the law firm. And that's why Gil Hardy is helping her land in the federal government with his friend Clarence Thomas. That's how she comes to work for Thomas. So she claims that he talks about pornographic films at the Department of Education. And then again, strangely goes over to follow him. And there were all these witnesses that testified during the hearing, right? Not a single person, man or woman, came forward to support Anita Hill's allegations in terms of a colleague of theirs, of the both of them, you know, who worked with both of them. In fact, most of them testified and said Anita Hill was just not telling the truth. Hmm. The two people that I mentioned earlier that Anita Hill gave to the FBI to go interview, Nancy Fitch and Allison Duncan, both disputed her account. So people that she was referring the FBI to disputed her story. And so you have this. And so again, on my website, I have video clips of all the different witnesses, you know, the 12 women who testified in support of Justice Thomas, several of whom were friends of Anita Hill and specifically disputed her account of what happened. And that's why, again, when the American people were watching this unfold, they ended up not believing her.
Yeah.
There was another, again, during the hearings. So you had this thing where Arlen Specter is the Republican who's picked to kind of do the questioning of Anita Hill. And I thought it was a brilliant move. Obviously, Senator Specter had voted against Robert Bork, was a very, very pro-choice senator, kind of a liberal Republican. But he was a very good lawyer, well-respected, and he's the one who questioned Anita Hill. There was this other kind of what I'll call, you know, it's a set of facts where, right, so she works for Clarence Thomas at the Department of Education, follows him eagerly, and everyone, all the women who testified said that when she was, you know, when he was changing jobs, she was one of the first to say, I want to go with Clarence Thomas. She gets over to the EEOC, it's a bigger agency, she kind of fails out of that, and then she leaves, and we'll return to that a little bit, but she leaves, and she lies about how she gets her job, her next job, which is that Clarence Thomas, who's always looking to help his staffers or his clerks, you know, it's just a through line through his entire career. Hmm. He gets to know this gentleman by the name of Charles Cothey, who I think helped Justice Thomas on his second confirmation to the EEOC. And now he's the dean of Oral Roberts Law School out in Oklahoma. And Anita Hill's from Oklahoma. So when Justice Clarence Thomas at the time EEOC chairman is going to speak out there, he always would bring along a staffer so that they could, you know, sort of get some exposure. So he tells Anita Hill he could go on this trip. Dean Cothey meets Anita Hill out in at this conference. He was having a conference on something. And she's from Oklahoma. He can, you know, he's interested in hiring her. And so he goes to Clarence Thompson and says, I'd love to hire Anita Hill. You know, what do you think? He's like, that would be great. That would be a great fit for her. And when you read Anita Hill's account of it, she tries to say that she tried to go behind Clarence Thomas's back, you know, that he would try and sabotage her efforts to leave and go out to Oklahoma. Dean Cothey, of course, who's at this point, he's in his 80s, I think, when he testified, is absolutely flabbergasted by this whole storyline and talks about how Clarence Thomas was her, you know, royal letter for her, you know, went to bat for her, was the big advocate of her, you know, going out to Oklahoma to work at Oral Roberts. Dean Cothey talks about how Clarence Thomas came to speak out there later on when Anita Hill had left, and that Anita Hill called him up and wanted to drive him to the airport, wanted to get breakfast with the three of them, invited him herself to a breakfast because Clarence Thomas would stay at Dean Cothey's home.
Wow.
So she calls up. And so that goes back to the fact that in the hearing, it's revealed. And remember, it's one of these things where, you know, tick tock, real time, these allegations are made, it bursts on the scene. And I can go through the little back and forth on that. But basically, when those allegations are made and things are dribbling out, one of the things that comes out is that there are all these phone logs of Anita Hill calling Clarence Thomas many times. I think it's 13 times after she had left the EEOC. So remember, she claimed she was sexually, you know, that Clarence Thomas does all this disgusting talk about, you know, pornography, follows him to the next job where she says it's settled down. One of her arguments in terms of trying to explain this craziness, her crazy story, in my view, is that he started dating a woman in the middle of like when she was working for him at the Department of Education. And that's why he stopped doing it for a while. Right. Another complete lie. Clarence Thomas was dating the same person through the entire time. Okay. So all of these things, I always likened it to she built this story on a whole kind of card of lies. And if you got one fact wrong, the entire thing could crumble. Right. And she just didn't know which one it was. So she just had to deny everything. You know what I mean? In terms of like all the inconsistencies. And so she first gets asked about these phone logs, like Clarence Thomas's secretary from the EEOC kept these phone logs. And so when Anita Hill is first asked about them, she says, I never called Clarence Thomas. I would have only called to return his calls. Right. Well, too bad for her. The secretary, Diane Holt, who actually testifies in this hearing and had been friends with Anita Hill, said, well, no, incoming calls. And then another log of return calls. And so she had the phone logs. She had all the messages from Anita Hill that said, hey, would love to see you. I'll be in town. Sorry, I missed you. I'm staying. Here's my hotel room. You know, here's my hotel. I'm staying in Washington, D.C. All of these very, you know, whatever, kind words. That if you had escaped the sexual harasser, presumably you would never want to talk to again. And that theme kept coming up again and again in the hearing with these sort of inconsistencies and her answers, which were just not plausible. There was another sequence where Anita Hill, Arlen Specter, there again, this is like the breaking news type of things. And there had been a USA Today story that said that Anita Hill originally was told by one of the Senate staffers that all you need to do is you don't need to come forward. You just need to make the allegation and Clarence Thomas will withdraw. And this was a USA Today story that, you know, she wanted to stay in the shadows. She would never need to come forward and have her story tested that Thomas would withdraw. Specter asks her about this. Like, did you have a discussion with somebody about that? And she says, I don't remember anything like that. And Specter is like, okay, you're talking about conversations and things that happened 10 years ago, and you can't remember a conversation that happened like 2 weeks ago on this stuff, or, you know, 3 weeks ago.
Right.
And in Specter's memoirs, he interviews Joe Biden, and Joe Biden says, I didn't believe her either.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
I thought she was lying about this. And I told, I took a break. I said, I started lunch early and I told my lawyers to go talk to her lawyers. This is Joe Biden saying she better refresh her recollection on this or I'm going to grill her on it. And so you see in the afternoon, Anita Hill come back and sort of sua sponte brings up this idea that, oh yeah, I do remember this conversation that yes, maybe the nominee would decide not to go forward. Inspector is stunned. And he says, isn't that inconsistent with what you just said this morning? And she says, no, I don't think it is. And he's like, he goes over it very sort of methodically. And she says, well, you can think that, but it's not inconsistent. And it's the next day when, if you recall, that Spector kind of goes through the transcript on his own that night and is ripped about it, and then accuses her of flat out perjury, he says, the next day. But it's that sequence. But again, as we sort of, I've spent a lot of time on this because I do think there were so many lies.
Yeah.
Spector, you know, shows that Joe Biden, he interviewed Joe Biden in 1999 for his memoirs. And Joe Biden admits that he did not believe Anita Hill, contrary to what he said when he started running for president in 2019. He didn't believe Anita Hill. And so Anita Hill, you know, files these allegations on September 23rd, right? She gets, and again, what it talks about is Clarence Thomas talking about pornographic movies and animal scenes and things like that, and pressing her for dates. That's essentially the sum and substance of her, and that she disagrees with him on like civil rights issues. It's kind of a strange thing in there. But in terms of the, what I'll call the sexual harassment type things, it's that, okay? She gets interviewed by the FBI, okay? That's submitted on September 23rd. I think she gets interviewed that night by the FBI. The hearing is, so what happens is, let's see, she gets interviewed by the FBI. She ultimately ends up testifying, I think, on October 11th. Okay. In that from when she gives her statement to the committee, when she gets interviewed by the FBI, and then when she testifies, her story dramatically changes to where Clarence Thomas is talking about, this becomes the famous, you know, pubic hair on the Coke can, right? And Long Dong Silver, and him starting to talk about like him doing things to women, right? In his own sexual prowess, I think she talks about. And it's absolutely, when I say night and day, it's just shocking, right? And the question is, why didn't you tell this? Why didn't you have these stories or this material when you submitted it to the committee, if they were so like memorable, right? Or when you got interviewed by the FBI? And she says, and Senator Spector asks her this, and she says, well, the FBI told me that if I were uncomfortable with talking about this stuff, they would come back, or I didn't have to talk about it, or they would be back for more additional details, and that's why I didn't tell them all this stuff. Well, those two FBI agents literally swore out affidavits in the middle of the hearing, right, or during these hearings, saying that's an absolute lie. We told her to tell us everything, and that if she, and it was a man and a woman who were there, the agents, and that if she were uncomfortable talking about this stuff in front of the male agent, he would step out and she could continue the conversation with the female agent. And that they only told her they would come back when that's a standard thing. At the end of an interview, they thank you and say, okay, if we have any more questions, we'll come back. She was never told that, at the beginning, as she tried to imply. So again, that was another thing that came out, was that, she was lying about her interactions with the FBI and why her story so dramatically changed. And again, when you think about it, this is where kind of the Joe Biden thing comes in. She submitted that statement in the FBI. So when the committee is going forward with the hearings, right, that's what they're working off is that's those stories from her statement. And they give Clarence Thomas the option to testify first, which he takes, right? And he comes in and he gives his opening statement, and they're about to start questioning him about Anita Hill's statement. And Joe Biden says, actually, I'm not going to let you, Senator Hatch, use Anita Hill's statement, because she still says it's confidential and she wants to actually tell her story in her own words. So we're not going to be able to use her statement. Hatch goes ballistic. It's one of the great scenes in the Senate hearing. And he's basically like, I will resign from this committee. This is outrageous. And I was a chief oversight counsel for 10 years on a committee. Somebody submits a statement and you're going to go into a hearing, you get to use that. It's the committee's document, right? And what Biden wanted to do, of course, was to allow, it would have been very confusing if people heard her first, story that Clarence Thomas gets questioned on. And then Anita Hill would come in and have this completely on steroids, amped up story, right? That had all these additional crazy facts. And so Biden basically says, they take a recess and they dismiss Clarence Thomas and they let Anita Hill come in. And to me, that's something that always gets overlooked a lot. But to me, that was a clear effort by the Democrats to help her story as much as possible, because it would have been very you know, I mean, at the end of the day, people didn't believe her, but it would have looked very suspicious that, you know, would have been really focused on this first statement that she made and then this kind of second one. So as I said, all of Anita Hill's witnesses were very weak. She, you know, she first claimed when she first came forward that she only told one person, Susan Hirshner. Susan Hirshner was a terrible witness. They sealed her staff interview. I learned that it was down in Senator Thurmond's personal records down in the, at Clemson University. I was looking online when I was doing some research back and I saw that Susan Hirshner's interview was in a folder. And I drove down there and I copied a lot of stuff. And it's up on my website now called AnitaHillCase.com. And I'm not sure what happened, but Senator Thurmond, I think, took a lot of records when he left, thinking they were his, you know, because senators can take their personal records and whether they were intermixed or not, you know, sort of, you know, with his personal and his committee files. Once I began talking about it, I think, or at some point, the National Archives came down and took all the committee files and they're back in, I think, under seal because they're supposed to be sealed for 50 years.
Wow.
But I copied a lot of it and it's up on my website. So the Susan Hirshner interview, I would encourage any of your listeners to go to AnitaHillCase.com and spend time on the documents that I have up there and my write-ups. You know, you can follow along with kind of my logic, if you will, but you can also see the underlying documents, right? And so just a not credible witness. You have that law professor. You have these people who don't really know her that well, right? Susan Hirshner is kind of a friend, but her credibility is shot by the end of, I think, her interview and when she testified before the hearing. Joel Paul was this law professor who claims that she was this Reaganite, which was completely false. You have a guy who seemed to be her boyfriend, but when she writes her own memoirs years later, doesn't call him that at all.
Right.
There's a lawyer up in New York that she spoke with. His name was John Carr. I think he says she never identified him as Clarence Thomas when she was talking about this alleged, you know, sort of harassment issues. Now, going back to Walt Harcray, the law firm she was at, there was a story in Diane Holt, who was, again, a career secretary at the EEOC and I think at education, that Anita Hill had claimed that she had been harassed at Walt Harcray, and that's why she was leaving, right? Now, we see, you know, from the Burke affidavit and other people that she was failing out at Walt Harcray. She had some story that some lawyer had, you know, whatever, sexually harassed her or said inappropriate things, and that she felt uncomfortable and he took work away from her. And that's why she was failing out. And I think that Clarence Thomas talks about that his friend had told him something to that effect, Gil Hardy, who, as your listeners may be, again, this is an old story. But Gil Hardy had died a couple of years earlier before the hearings. So the person who would have helped, you know, who helped Anita Hill get to Clarence Thomas, who could have blown apart her story, if you will, because he was there, because she was leaving, because she was failing at the law firm and knew the relationship. He had tragically passed away in a diving accident. And so that's another piece that, you know, in terms of like people stress testing, you know, representations, he had passed. So he couldn't rebut her story. Like with someone who worked for Clarence Thomas, didn't work with Anita Hill at all. You know, at the same time, she came along, she had been fired from earlier jobs. And she ends up, because somebody asked Clarence Thomas to hire her, she's a Black Republican, that she goes to work for him, I think, in 84, and she gets fired for calling for a lot of, I think, poor job performance, culminating in her, according to Justice Thomas, calling a fellow staff member a faggot. And Justice Thomas shut up at that point and fires her, kind of summarily leaves a note on her chair. And so she comes. So what happens is in these hearings, during the hearings, she is working down in North Carolina for a newspaper or is trying to get a job with a newspaper. And she writes this. I mean, she's working at the newspaper and she wants to be a writer. And so she writes this draft opinion piece or something about Clarence Thomas. And it gets leaked. This is the story. Yeah. Up to the committee. And it says that Clarence Thomas had, we don't know what it says because it's never been released, but it gets on the committee's radar and they want to interview her. And she essentially says, Clarence Thomas made comments about my body and he pressed her for dates. That's it. In her interview, she says it wasn't sexual harassment, but her allegations are that Clarence Thomas made these comments about her body parts and came by her house once to talk about, you know, you should be dating me, something like that. Now, go back to Angela Wright. Angela Wright had been fired from previous jobs. Clarence Thomas fired her. there was a friend of a mutual friend of theirs named Thelma Duggan who gets interviewed, and she by the FBI, and she tells them that Thelma Duggan, I mean, that Angela Wright had told her in the summer before all the Anita Hill stuff came up that she wanted to get Clarence Thomas back. She wanted vengeance on him. And so put that, you know, as a factor, right? Second one is she had been fired. She resigned. She was about to get fired from the State Department. And she worked for a woman named Kate Simrad, who she accused of racism. So she's not performing well. She gets a bad, like one of these performance improvement plans from Kate Simrad. This is at the State Department. This is before she comes over to work for Clarence Thomas, like I think in 1983. In response to this poor performance report, Angela Wright writes a letter back to Kate Simrad saying, "You're a racist. You're a horrible person. You're a racist through and through. And I resigned." Okay. She then, when she leaves the State Department, she writes a letter. At the same time, Kate Simrad had been nominated to be at another position at the State Department, right? So she's going to go through confirmation at the Foreign Relations Committee, which is the committee that, you know, sort of does those confirmations for State Department people. And Angela Wright writes a letter to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee accusing Kate Simrad of all these racist things, right? They hold up her nomination. They look into it and they determine it's all a lie, right? And there's a gentleman by the name, I think his name is Jay Morris, who sees this unfolding, you know, with the Hill-Thomas hearings and sees Angela Wright enter the sort of picture. And he writes a letter to the committee saying, this exact thing happened, you know, back in, you know, 1980, whatever it was, 1983, 84, with Angela Wright making these accusations against Kate Simrad. And they were false at the time. And the committee ultimately confirmed Kate Simrad. So here's a person whose credibility was at their, you know, just she was not a credible person.
Okay? Right.
And she comes again, she comes onto the scene and there's a story, right? Because what's the problem with Anita Hill's story? There's no pattern, right? Everyone who talks about sexual assault, sexual harassment is that there's always a pattern. If you've done it to one woman, you've done it to 10 people. And you see that happen with, you know, Andrew Cuomo, right? You see it with Bill Clinton. You see, you know, take your pick of the people.
Bill Cosby.
Exactly. Just scores and scores of women, right? Not a single person had ever come forward on the Clarence Thomas one. And people at the, you know, and the, all of these women who testified were like, we were around him all the time. This is impossible to happen. Democrats, Republicans, career people, when they testified at these hearings, that's why they were so powerful. That's why most people thought Anita Hill was lying. And so with Angela Wright, she makes these allegations. But because I think the Democrats saw, oh, this is their chance to take down Thomas. Here's a second woman. They subpoena her to come testify. The facts and history. There is a letter that Joe Biden writes to Angela Wright, dated October 13th, which is the last day of the hearings. It says, "Dear Ms. Wright, it is my preference that you testify before the Judiciary Committee in connection with the nomination of Judge Clarence Thomas. But in light of the time constraints under which the committee is operating and the willingness of all the members of the committee to have placed in the record of the hearing, the transcripts of the interview of you and your corroborating witness, Ms. Rose Jourdain, conducted by majority and minority staff, I am prepared to accede to a mutual agreement of you and the members of the committee, both Republican and Democrat, that the subpoena be vitiated. Thus, the transcribed interview of you and Ms. Rose Jourdain will be placed in the record without rebuttal at the hearing. I wish to make clear, however, that if you want to testify at the hearing in person, I will honor that request. Sincerely, Joe Biden." And then there's a signature underneath. It says, which Angela Wright signs, which is, "I agree. The admission of the transcripts of my interview and that of Rose Jourdain in the record without rebuttal at the hearing represents my position and is completely satisfactory to me." Okay. So this idea that Joe Biden sort of prevented a willing witness from testifying is absolute rubbish. Right. And so that's the Angela Wright one, right? She had lots of credibility issues that I've walked through. There are more, okay?
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, she was subpoenaed to testify, and she signed a document, right, that said, "I don't want to testify." And the other person, Rose Jourdain, who they talk about here, her corroborating witness, she's nothing of the sort. She worked at the EEOC. She was also fired by Clarence Thomas a little bit, a different time, I think. But they were sort of friends. Rose Jourdain was much older. And she, Rose Jourdain, claimed that Angela Wright would have these interactions with Clarence Thomas. I don't think she was ever around for any of them. But she'd come back distraught and almost afraid to come out of her office and just like trembling. Hmm. And when you listen, when you read Angela Wright, it's like, that Clarence Thomas was annoying to me. And, you know, and there was like the disconnect. And in terms of what he was commenting on, in terms of her body, completely the interviews do not corroborate at all, other than, you know, Clarence Thomas allegedly did something wrong. But in the details, it's absolutely a joke. And I think the Democrats knew. And the storyline is that Anita Hill's team did not want her to testify. You see that a little bit with the Kavanaugh stuff, right? With Julie Swetnick, right? And the absolute, you know, I don't believe Christine Blasey Ford. And I worked on the Kavanaugh confirmation, but the Julie Swetnick thing was in a completely different universe of like insanity, right? Insanity. And it made all of the allegations seem even less credible. They weren't credible to begin with, but even less credible. That's what was going to happen with Angela Wright. That's why the Democrats didn't want her to come testify. That's why, if you remember, Alan Simpson wanted her to come testify, right? Yeah. He had talked about the fact that we're getting a lot of information on this next witness that's coming in. And you know what? That's what happens when people make allegations, spurious allegations, and people are watching and they come forward with the information that they have on a person that's a witness. That's completely, you know, reasonable and expected. You know, you don't get to tell a lie and not be, you know, questioned on it. And right. So that's the other storyline that's grown up over the years, is that somehow, you know, there was a second witness. When you look at Anita Hill's sort of, in my view, so my view is Anita Hill had told a lie to a friend back when Thomas was first announced. And that story had its own life, like lots of those kind of lies do.
Right.
It made its way into Washington. And that's why when she talks about, you know, Anita Hill likes to present this view that she had a duty to report. She had a duty to come forward, but she did nothing of the sort. Thomas is nominated. Susan Hirshner calls Anita Hill and says, "Can't believe they're nominating that pig," or something like that. I don't think uses Thomas's name, but Anita Hill, and there's a sequence when Susan Hirshner is interviewed where she says something like, "I knew she knew that I knew," right? This is classic sort of Susan Hirshner. But the point is that she kind of gives her license to go tell this story, which ultimately ends up, right, because it's this Yale network of people in Washington, D.C. that are working, you know, in Democrat circles. And this kind of story gets into the bloodstream on the left and is percolating around. But when a couple staffers call Anita Hill to ask her about sexual harassment, Anita Hill is very, very evasive, doesn't say anything about Clarence Thomas or like that this had happened to her. So her idea that somehow she was ready and willing from the get-go is just a complete lie, okay? In her book, it's really interesting. Just because I read everything on Thomas, I force myself to read Anita Hill's book. She talks about how she was waiting for the FBI to come to her home during the whole summer, right? So what happens when she first gets approached by these, and they're not committee staffers, they were staffers that worked for committee members, so Howard Metzenbaum's staff. They reach out to her and she's cagey. And then what happens is they get an old friend of hers who works for Metzenbaum, Jim Brudney, to call her. They were very close. And if you look at the investigation, they had, I think, 22 phone calls or something like that in this time period. He's the one who convinces her of this idea of, look, all you need to do is make the charge and he'll withdraw. And you don't have to come forward, right? So when she wants to come forward and she's thinking about it, now the committee staff calls her. And this is literally during when Thomas's hearings are happening, right? So in September, because what's happening, Thomas is well on his way to confirmation.
Right.
And they need to. So they're trying to pull her forward and little by little. And so first, she doesn't want her name used. And when she first contacts the committee, she says, "I don't want my name used. I don't want Thomas to know it's me." And they're like, "Well, we can't do anything with that. I mean, what do you expect?" Nope. And so there's this back and forth. I think she first contacts the committee. And the rule is that you had to contact the committee, not the other way around. Okay, so she's talking to these other staffers that are not committee staff. But once she contacts the committee on September 12th, they don't hear from her again until September 19th. Okay, so think about that. Remember, Clarence Thomas's hearings end, I think, on the 16th, right? Yeah. So he's gone through. People think he's gotten through. He's well on his way to his confirmation. She now knows, okay, I need to do more, right? And when she finally sort of says, okay, I'm going to submit a statement or I'm going to do something like that. They tell her, okay, well, what's going to happen is the FBI is going to come and interview you because that's their standard protocol. People make allegations. The FBI will do an investigation. And she literally says, I don't want to talk to the FBI. I don't want to go forward with this right now. I want to think about the utility of the FBI. Right? Again, go back to her book written many years later where she claims that she's waiting for the FBI to come interview her,
right?
You know, like
right.
for them to find her and interview her, and she would willingly, I guess, talk to them. Now, when she approaches the committee and they say, okay, here's the standard protocol, the FBI is going to, she says, I don't want to go forward. And for like 2 or 3 days, she doesn't, you know, she's refusing to have the FBI and interview her and start the process. She finally sort of agrees on September 23rd. That's when she submits the statement, right? That's not an affidavit. She didn't swear it out when she submitted it. It was full of typos and grammatical errors. So she actually files another one a couple of days later to clean up this sloppily written document that she submits to the committee, a Yale educated lawyer. And so that's when the FBI comes and you read Susan Hirschner's, you know, when her interview about the idea that the FBI is coming to interview, what's going on here? Like, it's like this Gestapo, like they're going to sort of stress test their stories, you know?
Right.
And so anyway, so that's the how she gets to the committee. And it's not like she's got a story to tell and she contacts them and she's this. No, she's tried to do this behind the scenes without ever coming forward. And again, the other thing is when they do the investigation, the FBI, you know, does a quick investigation, but they talk to the key players. They determine, again, the FBI only sort of sets out facts, right? But
right.
one of the FBI agents calls Justice Thomas and says, there's nothing here. This is all like conjecture. And it's these old Yale friends that sort of gotten together. It goes to the committee and Joe Biden and all the Democrats review her allegations, right? Like on September 25th, okay? September 25th, September 26th. The vote is scheduled for September 27th. All the Democrats are made aware of her allegations and they all decide to go forward with the vote that this didn't rise to the level of any credible allegation. The Republicans, Strom Thurmond, who is a long-serving member of the Judiciary Committee, he decides it's so baseless, he doesn't need to tell anybody about it on the Republican side, okay? Arlen Specter finds out about it from Dennis DeConcini, a Democrat, and he asks to get briefed on it. So he finds out about it. But the key thing is, kind of this revisionist history, all these Democrats knew her allegations. They were kind of either reviewed the file itself or were briefed on it. And they all decided it wasn't credible enough and we're going forward, including Joe Biden. And Joe Biden, in his statement on the 27th, when he votes against Clarence Thomas, goes out of his way to talk about how Clarence Thomas is a man of character. And if anyone attacks his character, he's going to be the first one defending him. And it's clear, and everyone knows, that that was meant to be, I don't believe these allegations. And if anyone attacks you on that, I will be there to defend you. I'm not voting for you as a justice because I don't agree with your judicial philosophy. And I think you'll be dangerous on the court. But as a man of character, I got your back. Of course, he completely, you know, allows this whole circus to go forward and, you know, gets kind of, again, damages the process. But it's really, really interesting in terms of how this all unfolded.
Beautiful.
And then, you know, Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas gets confirmed 52-48, closest vote, successful vote in history. As I said, the American people believed him 58% to 24%, with only 26% of women believing Anita Hill. She goes on, you know, to kind of basically make a career being this so-called advocate,
professional victim,
so-called professional victim and sort of sexual harassment person to calling it out. But when you look at her conduct, and this is on my website, and I urge everyone to see it. She goes on Meet the Press in 1998 and absolutely trashes Kathleen Willey and Paula Jones and later Monica Lewinsky, and basically defends Bill Clinton and goes after like Paula Jones's allegations and how it doesn't amount to sexual harassment because she doesn't have any adverse employment consequences. She doesn't know sexual harassment law, which is just shocking. And I'll get back to the hearings actually on that score in a second. But yeah. This is what she says when Bill Clinton, when she's trashing, you know, these women who have come forward against Bill Clinton, who really was a serial harasser and exploiter. And according to Michelle Goldberg from the New York Times, a rapist. right? Of Juanita Broderick, who wrote, you know, what Michelle Goldberg wrote, the, you know, a very big lefty, I believe Juanita, right? But she attacks all of these women and says, when Tim Russert says, well, isn't this a double standard for conservatives? And she says, well, I think it is a reality that we have to live with. We live in a political world. And the reality is that we, there are larger issues other than just individual behavior. And she goes on to say, and what Bill Clinton has done doesn't rise to the level of us thinking, you know, we should support somebody else. So I take that, my own interpretation of that is you can sexually harass a woman. You can sexually assault a woman because that's what Kathleen Willey had obviously alleged.
Right.
So long as you're pro-choice, so long as we support your politics, we'll defend you. And, you know, and conversely, we will use these sorts of allegations, bogus or not, to go after our opponents. And you've seen that with the Kavanaugh. She jumps in on the Kavanaugh, right? But she defends Bill Clinton. Did she say a single word in the Andrew Cuomo thing? Again, an awful, awful sexual abuser of women. And no, she didn't say a single word, right? On Joe Biden, if you recall, when Tara Reid comes forward with sexual assault allegations, she is dead, stone cold silent for several weeks until the New York Times calls her. And of course, she has to say something. So she says she wants an independent investigation, right? Does it happen? No, nothing ever happens like that. And then she's clamoring to get on the Joe Biden bandwagon when she realizes he's going to win, right? She kind of trashes him when he gets into the race because people think he doesn't have a stand a chance. And they have that little back and forth where she says, he never apologized and I demand an apology, and he calls her and he actually doesn't apologize.
Right.
But then the Tara Reid stuff comes along and this is now when he's kind of the front runner and she's stone cold silent. Again, great advocate, right? I'm just gonna attack conservative politicians on this issue and make it weaponized so people don't believe, you know, lots of people.
Right.
When, you know, my view is that her conduct and many others in this weaponization have actually hurt the progress of stamping out sexual harassment. And she's to blame for that in a lot of ways. And so on the Joe Biden one, she issues this kind of wishy-washy thing that never happens in terms of an independent investigation. And then she's on the Biden bandwagon, wants to sort of, I think, be a consultant or something to Joe Biden, who she claims treated her horribly back during the confirmation, never apologized to her, gets accused of sexual assault during the race. And, you know, she's so that is my problem with Anita Hill. I don't think she told the truth back in 1991. And I've only touched on for your listeners just some of the inconsistencies, untruths in her story. There's piles upon piles of them, of people who came forward.
Yeah. So, Mark, as you mentioned, it was October 15th, 1991. The Senate confirmed Thomas's nomination 52-48, the closest Supreme Court confirmation vote in history. In its aftermath, our audience should know that Virginia Thomas, Ginny Thomas, of course, Clarence's wife, left Anita Hill a voicemail. I want to quote it to you and then perhaps get your thoughts on it. So in the voicemail message, the contents of which were confirmed by CBS News, among obviously others, Virginia Thomas said, begin quote, "I just wanted to reach across the airwaves and the years to ask you to consider something. I would love you to consider an apology sometime and some full explanation of why you did what you did with my husband. So give it some thought and certainly pray about this and come to understand why you did what you did. Okay, have a good day," end quote. Any thoughts?
Ginny Thomas is a fierce defender of her husband. I think, you know, she went through this hellish period of based on a lie. And I think it's always bothered her that, you know, her husband was accused of this conduct that he never did. And Ginny is very forthright, if you will, and direct. And she thought, you know, I'm going to call, you know, Anita Hill and leave this message. I think the kind of the most bizarre thing there is that Anita Hill called the FBI. Right. This is like classic Anita Hill. Like, she calls the FBI over a voicemail. And so I think this speaks more about Anita Hill than, again, Ginny Thomas. The Thomases have a wonderful marriage and they're both their biggest advocates and their best friends. And again, that's something that, in fact, Ginny Thomas is interviewed in the book, in our new book, and talks about the hurt and dealing with that And I think, as I said, the American people believed that Anita Hill was lying in those hearings. And so, yeah, you're going to want some recognition that there was a lie. But, you know, Ginny left that message. She's moved on. You know, she's the Thomases are focused on the future and all that. But I found it absolutely, I don't know, despicable that Anita Hill would call the FBI. And again, going back to her, I think she was involved with that group called Time's Up.
Yes.
And she wrote this, you know, she gets put on these boards to do all this stuff on sexual harassment. And it's a joke. If you looked at the report she issued a couple of years ago, I think they spent 3 years. It looked like it. I'll just say it's a joke of a report. I'll just leave it at that. And of course, we find out later that the people who are involved with that were advising Andrew Cuomo on how to, you know, slash and burn his accusers. And they actually, once that gets exposed, the whole thing blows up and I think it's imploded. But it just goes to show you the left does this. They weaponize this stuff. They cover up folks on their side from this kind of conduct. They allow women to be sexually harassed and sexually abused and sexually assaulted just so long as they're getting their way on different things. And you see that going all the way back to sort of Justice Thomas. And, you know, they require people to have certain views. And in this case, a black man, you're going to have certain views. And if you don't have them, we are going to absolutely destroy you. We will call you every horrible thing. We will look to blow you up with these sorts of allegations. But that's how the left works. And the Thomases have lived it, you know, both of them. Again, not to sort of zoom in across some things here. When Clarence Thomas was, and I was watching this with the Ketanji Brown Jackson hearing. So I was thinking about, right? I mean, I lived through those Thomas hearings, and I remember, I still have, I pulled them up recently and I wrote a little bit on it, maybe tweeted on it. But, you know, when Clarence Thomas is a black man who married Ginny Thomas, who's a white woman, okay, perfectly fine. But of course, during Thomas's confirmation, right, there were tons of stories about how Clarence Thomas hated black people because he married a white woman, okay, and that he's a threat, okay, to black Americans. Barbara Reynolds, who was a big time USA Today columnist, right, wrote a big story about that. The head of the Afro-American Studies at Howard University, Russell something, wrote an article or was quoted in a piece that was a Washington Post piece. And again, it's the Washington Post making this sort of normalized that you have these people saying, yeah, because you married a person of another race, you hate your own race. And you've made that choice. You've turned your back. Just imagine, right, that being said. And of course, at the time, of course, Thurgood Marshall was married to a woman who was not black at the time, right? It was his second wife. His first wife had passed away. But, you know, it gets to this thing is we will treat you nice if we agree with how you think. And that's the most despicable thing of all and all of this, because they just go after your life and your, you know, your jurisprudence, your, you know, whether you're qualified. It's just the Thomases. They're both strong people and they don't care about this. I do as their friend and having worked on it. But in any event, it's all the, you know, and just like not to, it's just like Ginny Thomas having her own career and being in the public square when tons and tons of other judges have spouses who are lawyers or do things in what I'll call the political realm. And they're celebrated for their partnership where they both have great careers and they both do X. But it comes to the Thomases, no. Ginny Thomas has to shut up and stay in the kitchen, essentially.
So, Mark, obviously you spent a lot of time thinking about Anita Hill as she relates to Clarence Thomas. Do you have any plans with your knowledge for the future?
You know, when the confirmation movie came out in 2016, and it had, in my view, all of these, you know, lies. In fact, when I wrote to, I think I threatened to sue HBO over their depiction of me. I think I came up with 78 lies or untruths in that movie that I posted somewhere on a site I had previous to my current sites. And then that site was called confirmationbias.com. And when I first wanted to kind of make a movie or kind of push back on it, it was to make the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas sort of movie or the, you know, the truth about those hearings. That turned into just a bigger movie on Clarence Thomas's life, which turned out to be a great, kind of a great decision, right, in terms of that. But that is something, you know, I went into the administration after that and come back out, have some time. I do feel like I want to set the record straight. I have a lot of material. My website, AnitaHillCase.com, has a lot of it there. But it's going back over all of that material and piecing it together to show why her story never added up, and you know why the American people were absolutely correct, including women. I mean, women didn't change from today to, you know, back then in terms of watching things and drawing their own conclusions, right? And so when only 26% of women believe a woman who's making these allegations, that's pretty damning in my view. So I hope to do something, maybe a book, something to put it all together and get it out there in some form. Because when you talk about the Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill hearings, people, you know, and particularly young people, have zero idea about what really happened and what the facts were. And when you start talking about different things, like the witness who says, the key witness, that she talked to Anita Hill in September, in the spring of 1981, about being sexually harassed by Clarence Thomas. And it turns out that, you know, she wasn't working for Clarence Thomas back right. then. And fact upon fact, my view in terms of, you know, correcting the record, I want to do something on that, whether that's a book or something else, we'll see. But I think I have some time, and I hope to be able to do it in the future.
Fantastic.
And, you know, you have Orrin Hatch, Senator Hatch, being interviewed saying Joe Biden told him at the time he didn't believe Anita Hill. You had Arlen Specter interviews Joe Biden on tape for his memoirs, for Biden's, for Specter's memoirs, saying, I didn't believe Anita Hill on some key points. You have actually Joe Biden leaving a voicemail for Clarence Thomas the night he is confirmed, saying, congratulations, Judge, don't let this get you down. You have 30 years to show the American people what you are, a person of character. So that doesn't sound like somebody who, if you believed Anita Hill, would be saying that to the guy, you know, who's just been confirmed. So no, very, very disappointed in Biden and how he held those hearings. The fact that he didn't believe her and let them go forward and was kind of, you know, whether he was forced or whatever, he allowed those hearings to go forward.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. So as you look back at the hearings, Mark, I'm curious, is there a particular moment that stands out for you?
The hearings, obviously Clarence Thomas's high-tech lynching speech, you know, just going back in there and calling out the Senate. Remember, I talked about when I first read his speeches and just throwing it down. And, you know, to this day, when I watch that, it's so emotional for me. So obviously that was just a great, great day in the hearings. And then, yeah, I mean, it was such a slog through the whole time. And to have that happen at the last minute was just so awful and despicable. But for Clarence Thomas to come back and just call him out and show the American people, right, that this was a lie. And if you remember those hearings, and this is what, again, with the my view, kind of the narrative that the left, I'll just call it, has continued for the past 30 years, people forget that at the end of those hearings, right, the New York Times CBS poll right after those hearings ended, was that it was 58-24, the American people believed Clarence Thomas was telling the truth, right? And only 26% of women believed Anita Hill was telling the truth. So when you think about that, right, everyone was captivated by those hearings. Everyone watched them if you were a certain age and stopped everything you were doing. And they watched all the witnesses. They watched Clarence Thomas testify. They watched Anita Hill testify. They watched the various witnesses testify. And at the end of the day, right, they said Thomas was telling the truth. No kind of filter from the media about what they wanted to focus on and what they wanted to say or how they wanted to slant the news. It was like just watching the whole hearings and making that assessment. And since then, it's been this drumbeat of somehow trying to reverse that through the years. And in fact, I was finally fed up with that when in 2016 with the movie Confirmation, which was on HBO with Kerry Washington, with again, just another kind of smear tactic campaign against Justice Thomas with new facts that are just false, like Angela Wright was somehow prevented from testifying. This was this so-called second woman who didn't work with Thomas and Anita Hill at the time, was coming to testify and got cold feet at the end of the day. She was a not credible witness. And I could tell you sort of all the facts about that. But at the end of the day, she signed a letter that Joe Biden said to her. That's Joe Biden's letter starts off, my preference is that you testify. She had been subpoenaed. My preference is that you testify, but I understand that you don't. And we're going to put your committee interview into the record and I will release you from the subpoena. And she signs it. But somehow, some crazy way, this becomes that she gets suppressed from testifying before the committee. So if you recall, that movie had Jennifer Hudson as Angela Wright. So this was kind of the new tack that if only these other people were allowed to testify, you know, Justice Thomas wouldn't have been confirmed. It was all a lie. I was fed up with it. I was kind of further along in my career, and I set up two websites and I wrote a lot. In fact, in that movie, I got an advanced copy of the script, and it had me in there 7 or 8 times. In every single scene, I was this like terrible lawyer, you know, sleazy lawyer, but every single scene was a lie. And I wrote to HBO and I said, I will sue you if these scenes are in there. And they assured me, oh, you got an old copy of it. It's no longer the relevant one. It turns out that the actor that was playing me, Mark Paoletta in the movie, they switched. At the end, they took this character out of the White House counsel's office. They took my name off of it. I think they had some of these still sleazy scenes in it, but it was no longer Mark Paoletta, right? It was, I guess, a composite figure or something like that. But it was that kind of stuff that I was just fed up with. And I said, you know, how do you make a movie to tell a fair movie to tell Justice Thomas's life, you know, because it's an amazing life.
Yeah.
And so through, you know, various conversations, I connected up with Michael Pack, who had talked to some people, and he was interested in making a movie on Clarence Thomas. And so I helped Michael Pack with that movie, which became Created Equal, Clarence Thomas in His Own Words. And when Michael first agreed to do it and was starting to do the work, I took Michael down to Pinpoint, Georgia. I took him down to Savannah because I know Justice Thomas's mom and friends down there, and took him around so we could see, you know, where Justice Thomas grew up and talked to. We got some photos from his mom. It was just a great exercise. And then, you know, convincing, because when he first signed up to do the movie, Justice Thomas had not agreed to participate in it. And so that was tricky. I had told Michael Pack, who had made movies on documentaries on George Washington and Alexander Hamilton, hey, you've made great movies on other people you didn't get to interview, Hamilton and Washington. But he's like, that's not the same thing. But fortunately and ultimately, Justice Thomas did agree to be interviewed. And it turned into, like, just like Justice Thomas does on anything, you know, he has so many people are pushing him or pressuring him on different things. But once he decides he wants to do something, he goes all in. So what was essentially, I think, was going to be like a 6-hour interview became a 25-hour interview over 6 sessions. I think probably the most of any filmmaker, certainly, to ever interview a sitting justice. And in the early part of it, Justice Thomas had recommended to Michael, you know, you should talk to my wife if you really want to get like a complete perspective on me. And so Michael ends up interviewing Ginny for 6 hours. And it was so good and so compelling. We actually put it into, she's in the movie a few times. But when we made this book, there's an appendix on Ginny Thomas. So we make the movie. It's this, you know, it's Michael Pack's film that I helped him on. And it's released in theaters, does very, very well, gets great reviews in it. It then goes on PBS, national broadcast on PBS. And when we made the movie out of 25 hours, he's just seeing all of this material that's cut away, cut away, cut away, right? All these great exchanges that Clarence Thomas is having with Michael Pack. It was killing me, right? Because there are lots of pieces that were, to me, just resonated so well about like the what I'll call the magic of Clarence Thomas and how he describes things, right? In a very relatable way. Contra sort of this Joe Biden buffoonery, right? Where he's talking about natural law, you know, being able to explain something in very relatable terms shows that you have a total command of it, right? And that's what Justice Thomas does. And so anyways, it was all this extra material. And when I left the administration, we went to Regnery in March of 2021 and pitched this book. There are all these, you know, extra stuff that didn't get into the movie because the movie is only 2 hours in length, obviously, right? And probably there's probably an hour and change maybe of Justice Thomas directly talking to the camera. And so Regnery was excited about it. And that's what's become this book, Clarence Thomas in His Own Words. It's kind of the extended interview with Clarence Thomas over these 6 sessions and with Ginny Thomas.
Excellent. No, excellent, Mark. And yeah, I want to ask about the book in depth a bit more in a minute as well. Some ground that I do want to cover, albeit I'll have to admit with some trepidation, because as I mentioned, this is a history podcast, not a political podcast as such, but it seems silly to me. And frankly, if I'm being honest, a little cowardly for me to ignore it. So of course, Justice Thomas played a key role in the recent Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization decision. for our listeners, this interview is taking place on June 29th. So we're, I guess, 5 days after the decision. It seems to me, just briefly, that one could be even pro-choice and be against Roe v. Wade as a legal matter in terms of the now no longer legal stand that abortion isn't a constitutional right. I know you've said as much in interviews. You were interviewed by Kevin Roberts recently and said something very similar. I'd love to know, would you care to give your thoughts on the decision and Justice Thomas's role in it?
Sure. So I thought it was a great, great decision. You know, Roe v. Wade was an abomination as a constitutional matter from the day it was issued, just like Plessy was, right? Should have been overturned many, many years ago. It's returning, right? There is no right to an abortion in the Constitution. It should be decided at the state legislature. And that's what the opinion essentially said, right? That the Roe's history and reading was all a lie. There was no tradition and there's no language that supports it. In terms of Justice Thomas's role, I think that, to me, it showed his humility. He is the senior justice in that majority. So by right, he could take that opinion for himself. And there's no justice who's written more on overturning Roe v. Wade, certainly voting for it. He voted to overturn Roe v. Wade in 1992. And then he wrote on why it's, you know, has no place in the Constitution and why it's so barbaric, right? He writes these opinions with very graphic details of partial birth abortions and all that. So very passionate, obviously. He's a justice and he's obviously writing an opinion on this issue, but he assigns it to Sam Alito. And I think that, you know, through this unprecedented attack on the Supreme Court with the leak of the Dobbs opinion, my view, Josh, is that his courage in writing these opinions over the years, time and time again in dissent, and how he stood up to the mob sort of personally and through his career helped give strength to the other justices to write an opinion that is so bold, to get it right, to bring it back, to be faithful to the Constitution. So, and of course, Justice Thomas uses the opportunity, right, in his concurrence to take on substantive due process and the kind of the violence to the language that that represents, right? Due process. The due process clause is you can't take life, liberty without due process, meaning a process. And yet right. It's been turned into over the years some kind of right that, and you see before the 14th Amendment, you had Roger Taney essentially having a substantive due process right that you couldn't free slaves, right, in the Dred Scott decision. So something that no doubt, obviously, Justice Thomas resonated with him and why he, I think, just the language of it, but obviously coming out of it, and he cites the Dred Scott decision and the absurdity of the kind of that language. And in the book, he talks about communication and using words and not twisting words to mean something else is incredibly important, not just in opinions, but in life. And so I think he had an incredible role, if you will, in the Dobbs case, obviously being in the majority, but showing that courage for 30 years that helped the other justices both write that opinion, if you will, the boldness of it, to not buckle when it was leaked and people were illegally protesting outside of the justices' homes and actually having assassins come and try and kill a justice, that the strength of Justice Thomas, who they all look up to, of course, and were young, a lot of them were young clerks, you know, working at the Supreme Court and, modeling themselves after his courage as a justice.
Yes. Well said. Excellent.
Yeah. And just again, just in terms of his concurrence, you know, as he's done throughout his entire career, planting seeds on different issues for the court to revisit. And that's what he's done. And, you know, if you look at this term from Roe v. Wade to the Second Amendment case, which he first wrote on, I think, in 1997 in the Prince case, right, which became essentially Heller with the Scalia decision. And of course, then the free exercise, religious freedom test, religious liberty case of Kennedy, Coach Kennedy, where Justice Thomas is always talking about how absurd it is to have this balancing test with the Lemon test and all that. So all of these things came to fruition, as we see, in the past couple of weeks and in this term, but particularly in the last couple of weeks, with my view of the court aligning itself with what Justice Thomas has been writing for many, many years.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you, Mark. So yes, I do want to discuss the book. Once again, titled Created Equal, Clarence Thomas in His Own Words, co-authored, as you said, with Michael Pack, following his phenomenal documentary, which I agree everyone should go out and watch by this time tomorrow. What prompted you to write the book, Mark?
So when we made the movie, you know, we talked a little bit about that. When you have 25 hours of interview footage and you need to get it down to a 2-hour movie, you're just going to lose so many great exchanges. And I'll tell you, if you don't mind, because the part that I always think about in terms of sitting there. So I was sitting there during the interviews. So Justice Thomas was talking about the fountainhead and libertarianism. And there's this, I'll do the short version, but it's on page 136 and 137 of the book. And he says, let's take an example. We agree that it was wrong for me to be prevented from going to the Savannah Public Library. Okay, people agree. That's just against society. Okay, what if they let me go in the library, but they said there's a certain part of the library or certain stacks in there that are off limits to Blacks? Oh, that would also be wrong. Okay, what if they say there are certain books that are marked no coloreds allowed? Would that be right? No, that would be wrong. If all those things are wrong, it's wrong for them to prevent me from being in the library. It's wrong for them to prevent me from going to certain parts of the library. It's wrong for them to prevent me from going to certain books in the library. Why is it right for them to tell me I can't have certain thoughts that are in the books in the library? Obviously, there's no answer. It's absurd. And, you know, obviously, Justice Thomas has this amazing voice, and I still remembering listening to him say that and thinking, wow, I can't wait for people to hear that. You know, now this was in 2017, 2018. And when you come to make the movie, and that's a long setup, you know what I mean? I don't know, that would be 30, 40 seconds. You know, you can't get it into the film. And I remember being like, one of the things that I loved sitting there, there's lots of parts, but that particular phrase or that particular exchange, you know, and that was not going to get in the movie. I talked to Michael about it and he's just like, Mark, it's great, but we just can't fit it in the film. Was okay, how do I capture this stuff and not lose it to, like, you know, to forever? And so it was, let's get a book and pull it together. And, you know, it's a lot more work than I thought it was going to be. And so I went through it all. And I originally was going to do it in terms of a Justice Thomas on the issues and break it out into, you know, affirmative action or, you know, and kind of on issues and not so much his life. But his discussion of the issues is so intertwined with his life and his grandfather and the lessons he learned that I went back to just, you know, kind of as the movie is and as the interview was basically conducted chronological. And then I added a bunch of footnotes, which I encourage your listeners to go to. More information, obviously, and all that on what Justice Thomas is referencing or talking about. So that was the reason why I made the book. It's this continuation of a lifelong or a very long time effort to correct the lies about Justice Thomas, to talk about his great life, talk about his amazing jurisprudence, his powerful jurisprudence, and to just get it out there. And again, the movie's fantastic, but you don't go back and watch a movie multiple times. Some people do, but in terms of having accessibleness to Justice Thomas's thoughts and ideas and wisdom, if you will, you can have a book on your bookshelf, you can have it on your desk, whatever. You can open it up and just start flipping around and reading something that, you know, is of interest to you. So it was capturing it all and getting it out there and then having it accessible in a book form for people to use.
Excellent. I love it. The book was launched on, I believe it was the 21st.
Yes.
Awesome. So we're just a shade over a week. How's the initial reception been, Mark?
It's been good. It was rising up on Amazon and got up to 65. And my view is there's a lot of stuff out there. This is going to be, it's been well received. This is the number one bestseller in different subcategories on Amazon. Awesome. But my view is, just like Justice Thomas, it's a long game. And I'm going to be talking about this book in the summer and the fall and getting it out there and be a great Christmas gift or a birthday present for a loved one or a present to yourself. So I'd urge everyone to go buy it. You're going to love it. But I'd also encourage you to watch the movie because that's much more emotional. Watching Justice Thomas's life unfold on the screen is really, really captivating.
And the all-important question, where can people get the book, Mark?
Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookstores. You know, it's available Kindle, audio. So it's a great read, and I encourage everyone to go buy it.
as they say, wherever fine books are sold, right?
Correct.
This is awesome. Mark Paletta, how can people find out about you, sir?
I'm at Mark Paletta on Twitter. I also set up two websites. One of them is called justicethomas.com, and that's got a lot of articles on Justice Thomas, speeches by Justice Thomas, videos of some of his speeches. And then I set up this other website called AnitaHillCase.com, which is, to me, a comprehensive website that talks about every witness that testified and why Anita Hill's case didn't add up. And again, it's AnitaHillCase.com. So I'm on Twitter at Mark Paoletta. And yeah, that's where I am.
Excellent. Mark, this was such a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time for me, sir.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. You take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on eyewitness history, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.